Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The United States is the world's largest steel importer, buying it from 110 countries to feed the fires of post-Great Recession consumption, up 53% between 2009 and 2016. The good news is that the cost of steel is down, making cars and other goods cheaper for the American consumer. The bad news is that lower prices for imported steel hurts the domestic steel industry. Coming up, President Trump's threats to impose steel tariffs, the issue with national security, and the impact on the domestic steel industry and the larger U.S. economy. Also, Ohio's current role in the steel industry. The Buckeye State's steel-making roots are as old and as deep as the state itself, surviving a revolving door of threats from mergers, the Depression, new technologies, and new competitors. Joining us to talk about that is Columbus Dispatch reporter Dan Guarino. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be here.
And steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania, Christopher Plummer. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Also with us, Vice President and Managing Director of Public Policy Services at the Ohio Manufacturers Association, Ryan Augsburger. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Glad to be with you.
Christopher Plummer, I guess to start with you, why did Ohio, or in fact the region itself, become such a big steel region?
Well, it dates back into the last century, really, where Ohio, because of its geographic location, it's in the midst of the main metallurgical coal mining areas of the United States, and also relatively close to the iron ore sources, which are primarily based up in northern Michigan and northeastern Minnesota. And then you've also got the fact that it's in the heart of the Midwest and the Great Lakes area. So it was just a very natural fit for Ohio to develop early on, and to still to this day largely maintain as one of the largest production sites for steel. And in fact, it's still the second largest after all these years, only behind the state of Indiana.
Are other states known for their steel business suffering the way Ohio is?
I would say Ohio is no different in that regard than most of the other traditional northern unionized steel or manufacturing sectors. I mean, we have this whole wave of change, long-term change, that has been going on in the United States for decades now. That includes things like demographic shifts to the South and even offshore. The material competition in the steel industry, a very big thing is, unfortunately, union versus non-union. And that's played a major role in the reduction in manufacturing and steel activity in Ohio. And then you could also say to the general Walmartization of the U.S. economy, and steel is part of that. In other words, people have to decide, do they want that? Do they want to protect jobs, or do they want the low-cost imports? And now, you know, the issue of national security and things like that are being raised. But that's, in simple terms, what's been going on, but for decades.
I read that the high number of steel producers in the U.S. historically made it difficult to react to market forces. Christopher Plummer, is that right? And why is that? Why would a lot of steel producers make it hard to react?
I'm not so sure I would totally agree with that.
Okay.
However, I would say that the U.S. steel industry, many of the downstream markets, distribution, service centers are still relatively fragmented. And that characteristic takes away power that these industries would otherwise have. Although I must say that in the steel industry now, we've consolidated from several dozen steel players to really 90% of the market is now controlled by less than 10 steel companies. So I would say today we're looking at a much healthier market in that regard. It's still facing all of these international pressures, but it's healthier, at least in that regard, that it is consolidated to a very significant degree.
Dan Guarino, what are we looking at in Ohio in terms of the number of steel producers that are left?
Well, in Ohio, you've got kind of close to Columbus, you've got a Nucor steel mill in Marion, which by some measures and of certain products is the largest steel producer in the country. You've also got AK Steel, which is based in the Cincinnati area and has several plants across the state. You've also got a number of companies that are not necessarily mill operators, but are just tightly entwined with the steel industry. And that includes like Worthington Industries here in Columbus. That includes Timken, the ball bearings and other products company in the Canton area. So lots of companies that have been around for a long time and are just really closely associated with the economies of their local areas.
How much, Ryan Augsburger, how much of Ohio's manufacturing, you know, of all the manufacturing in Ohio is related to the steel industry?
Quite a bit. As was mentioned earlier, Ohio ranks second domestically for steel production. So We're behind only Indiana. A lot of steel comes out of the Buckeye State. Manufacturing as a whole is $109 billion in our state's economy, largest private sector by a lot. Of that $109 billion, $2 billion comes from steel. So quite a bit of tonnage, and that's 8.8% of that industry's national contribution to the GDP.
So when we talk about things sort of in a vacuum, Christopher Plummer, it sounds good. Things are going okay. What's the problem?
Well, I would say I could list a few, and they're pretty significant, unfortunately.
Okay.
I had mentioned before, we've got this ongoing battle between unionized companies, mostly in the North, but not totally, and non-union companies. And the non-union companies use a different technology, electric arc scrap-based steel making. And they tend to be much more efficient, much more profitable, and they're now controlling almost 70% of all of the steel output in the United States. I mentioned the demographic shifts moving from the north to the south and even offshore, things like that. But I would say even beyond that, Anne, is the fact that the steel industry is not only a sort of a fixed pie, the size of the market, it's actually declining in volume. So you have a situation which is somewhat untenable for most of the players. In other words, it's difficult to grow one's business, to increase the value of your company in a market where it's less than a zero-sum game. From the last two recessions, for example, where steel consumption reached an average of 137 million tons. In this current expansion, the peak looks to be in 2014, where demand was 120 million. That's a substantial 17 million ton decline. That's the equivalent of the output of six average steel plants. So you're in a market, again, that is not only just flat or not growing, but it's shrinking. And that's difficult for the majority of players to really remain in attractive investments for the financial community, to be able to get the cash they need and so forth. So you really only have a couple of companies in this difficult environment that are doing fairly well. And those are companies like Nucor, Steel Dynamics, and some of the others that Dan had mentioned.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about steel and the impact of imports on the steel industry in the state of Ohio. You just heard from Christopher Plummer. He's a steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. Also with us, Ryan Augsburger, vice president and managing director of public policy services at the Ohio Manufacturers Association, and Columbus Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Christopher Plummer, historically, government policies when it comes to the industry. I read that industry executives wanted to dispense with wartime controls after World War II. The government didn't agree. What sort of controls were in place then, and what kind of government controls are in place now?
Well, the steel industry is worldwide is somewhat unique in that there are no general fixed tariffs in place. All of the tariffs or duties that you see in place in the steel industry, and there are many, there are currently, just in the present moment, there are 152 active anti-dumping countervailing duty cases that are, again, currently active, and another 25 that are pending. So the U.S. relies on the, you know, the individual court cases that are filed through the Commerce Department and the International Trade Commission. What we're looking at now, or what the current administration is looking at, is what's called a Section 232, which is related to national defense. Mm-hmm. So that's what's the main thing in front of not only the industry, but in the government right now. And that Section 232 was part of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, and it allows the president, assuming it is backed by Congress, to impose duties on a wide range of companies and products if it is deemed that they are causing risk to the national defense. So that's the biggest thing that's going on out there. A 232 case has only been invoked twice in the entire U.S. history, once in 1999 against imported crude oil, and a second time in 2001 related to the iron and steel industry. However, in both cases, Commerce opted not to act or proceed on them. So what we're looking at now is a third instance of the 232 provisions being invoked, and we'll have to see what happens.
Well, I was under the impression that the president didn't need congressional approval to activate that Section 232.
It depends. He has his Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, who was founder and president of ISG, which in the early part of the 2000s had bought up and consolidated a lot of the major integrated steel companies in the United States, like Bethlehem, Acme, LTV, etc. All those companies have now been spun off and sold into ArcelorMittal, which is the world's largest steelmaking company by far. Wilbur Ross is the Secretary of Commerce, and he does have a fair amount of leeway. And it, with him in that position, in his pro-232 stance, this is a much different situation than we had in these prior two instances, including in 2001 under George Bush, when he didn't have quite even the internal support of his, you know, to the extent that he has with Wilbur Ross.
So in 1999 and 2001, then the administrations just felt more comfortable going through Congress and seeking approval, but that isn't necessarily required.
It's a little bit vague. I mean, the definition of national security
right.
is a fairly vague concept. And if you look at it, in that 2001 trade case during the Bush administration, the Section 232, it was determined that the defense sector accounted for only 0.3% of all the steel consumed in the United States. So it's somewhat difficult to argue that you would that there's a national defense issue, at least across the board, because it's a very small, minute amount of products that are, you know, by clear definition, defense related.
We'll continue our conversation about the future of steel in Ohio and the United States, given the new administration's point of view on tariffs. Still with us, you just heard from Christopher Plummer. He's a steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. Also with us, Ryan Augsburger. He's vice president and managing director of Public Policy Services at the Ohio Manufacturers Association, and also Columbus Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about steel in Ohio and the rest of the country. President Trump has threatened to impose tariffs on countries that import steel to the U.S., a move that may bring more jobs back to the U.S. steel sector, but at a cost to U.S. consumers. The president is scheduled to hold a rally tonight in Youngstown in the heart of the Mahoning Valley, where steel production reached all-time highs in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Since World War II, though, demand has dropped. The domestic steel industry has faltered, and the industrial base of the region has faded. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Dan Guarino, steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania, Christopher Plummer, and also vice president, managing director of public policy services at the Ohio Manufacturers Association, Ryan Augsburger. Welcome again, all. I want to kind of go back, Ryan Augsburger, to just what all of this means. We've been talking about the tariffs, what the president is proposing. The manufacturing sector of the United States in general has opposed these such tariffs. Why?
Well, manufacturing is core to our state's economy, and steel today, it's high tech. It's a critical component. It has a great wage base. There are a lot of great attributes to steel making, like other categories in manufacturing. And while steel is impacted by government policies, both from the costs and regulatory burdens that can be imposed both at the federal and the state level, things like taxes and legal environment, steel manufacturers are in a global competitive marketplace. And there is a lot of examples of state-subsidized activity. So foreign-made steel coming in from other countries is methodically subsidized. We call this dumping in order to gain market share. And so you have seen, as was just alluded to, steelmakers file actions with the U.S. Department of Commerce and International Trade Commission to pursue countervailing duties to offset. So they impose a tariff on incoming steel, and then the damaged steelmaker can receive those proceeds in order to make themselves whole. Steelmakers have filed many of these cases in these different federal and international jurisdictions. Sometimes they've won, sometimes they've not. It depends. It's not as easy as saying steel. There are different products of steel. For example, steel pipe, which is in great demand, or at least it has been in the last 5 years due to the great demand for new oil and gas drilling and fracking. You need a lot of steel pipe and very strong seamless steel pipe. That is a product that has been especially susceptible to foreign dumping, and we've seen a lot of trade cases. Advocates for steel, both at the national and the state level, have generally supported these cases to protect our strategic, our steel industry, because if we don't, then they will continue to threaten the viability of Ohio and our nation's steel industry. That's the core of American manufacturing and innovation. And
but a blanket tariff?
It's generally pursued on a specific steel product. So it would depend on product by product. And of course, the precedent, if it's allowed on one product, then it can expand to other categories of steel or downstream to the multitude of products that rely on steel for their construction, such as appliances or cars.
Yeah. And Dan Guarino, are most Ohio steel companies engaged in these legal battles over tariffs or dumping at some point? Are they in some stage of that?
Well, they're definitely aware. It's often going to be through like a trade association,
right,
or through. It's important though to note that there's the companies that make steel. There's a lot more companies that buy steel. You know, that are produced.
Yeah.
And for example, like Ohio, you know, Manufacturers Association members, there are going to be a lot of those that, you know, are making washers and dryers, or making cars, or making. And so it's this, the whole issue of kind of steel dumping is this double-edged sword in Ohio, because it's one of the key costs for manufacturing some of this stuff, and you've got the producers and you've got the buyers right here. So it's a lot of times state leaders here and kind of leaders of corporate groups are. It becomes kind of complicated to kind of try to thread the needle and try to take action against what are seemingly the most egregious examples of dumping from other countries, but at the same time not going so far that it hurts the manufacturers that buy steel.
Christopher Plummer, what's the rest of the world doing? I mean, where there's big manufacturing, are they having the same kind of problems with dumping that the United States is?
I would say, for the most part, similar advanced country regions like Europe, Japan, Australia are having very similar issues. I think the U.S. situation is magnified because of the fact that it has a significant premium or price premium here that has really been prevailing for the last 4 or 5 years over any other major country in the world. So there's just a lot of reasons for foreign steelmakers to be attracted here. There are no underlying base tariffs. The only people who get tariffs are the ones who have been found to violate trade rules. So nothing, you know, just standard underlying tariffs, that sort of thing. And you've got a market that is very sophisticated. It's arguably the most sophisticated in the world in terms of the qualities of the products that are used. And as I said, the steel products are being sold at the highest prices of anywhere in the world. So there's a lot of reasons why imports are being attracted here. And I agree with Dan and Ryan that even though I'm a clear free trader, mm-hmm, I agree that the laws that are in place should be enforced. In many cases, they're not fully enforced. I think the procedures for filing anti-dumping or countervailing duties should be relaxed. It takes a lot of money, and typically it takes up to 2 years to prove financial injury. And we've had some reductions in the level of that proof that needs to be determined or proven. Some of that has taken place in the last year or two, and I think that has resulted in more trade cases being filed with somewhat better results for that. But around the world, yeah, companies are facing similar problems with dumping from particularly countries like China, South Korea, and a number of others.
I'm going to turn to some callers right now. Howard in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Howard.
The reason I'm calling is when people think of steel mills that have gone out of business, they think of blighted areas up in the Rust Belt of northern Ohio, like Cleveland, Youngstown. Both of my folks grew up in Portsmouth, which completely surrounds the village of New Boston. And for a long, long time, Detroit Steel had a steel mill located there in New Boston. I used to go down to Portsmouth a lot when my grandparents were living, and there were 60,000 people living in Portsmouth. Last time I visited the town, which was in 2008, the population was down to 20,000 people. And I was just wondering if anybody on your panel was familiar with New Boston and the Detroit steel mill that had been there for a long time but shut down in 1976.
Yeah. Dan Greeno?
I'm not familiar with that specific example.
Yeah. Ryan?
Yeah, it was a giant steel facility, and as in some other parts of the state, you see those legacy steel integrated mills no longer in existence. In many cases, they've been razed, and now there's redevelopment. There's a steel foundry nearby to that site now called Osco that makes some tremendous products that has been constructed in the last 30 years.
With many fewer employees.
Many fewer employees, but, you know, a lot of the mills that people talk about, they had a run for 100 years. And you have new, it was mentioned earlier, the mini mills, the arc furnaces. There's two ways to make steel. The traditional way was the Bessemer process with blast furnaces. We have two of those still in operation in Ohio. But most of the newer steel mills, and when I say newer, I'm talking about 30 years, the 1980s and 90s, we have some very high, great technology and state-of-the-art steel manufacturing in Ohio. They're not in the same places. Sometimes they're in different places for a variety of reasons.
Howard, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to talk about what the tipping point is, and if you know, Christopher Plummer or Ryan Augsburger, if you guys have analyzed where that is. Christopher Plummer, you described yourself as a free trader, but if you give a break to the steel manufacturers, there's going to be a hit down the line that's going to eventually end up in the consumer's shopping basket, meaning less in the shopping basket. They won't be able to afford the materials.
Yeah, well, this is Chris here. I'll just give a quick point on that. There are always, in anything we do, in business, politics, personal, you have to really think through the ramifications of what your actions will trigger. And you know, no more so than in the case of steel trade actions. I think, as Dan mentioned, you know, the steel industry employs about 130,000 people. If you look at the auto sector, the auto sector employs five or six times that. And all of the other, the appliance sector, things like that. So you have to look at balancing the impact and make sure, all right, if we're going to impact or benefit one sector, what are the ramifications here? And this is a big issue with us as we try to get people to think these things through. The other thing is companies are going to start importing value-added products containing steel. So in other words, appliances, automobiles, or whatever. There's over a million tons of fabricated structures, you know, made with steel beams and, you know, so bridge spans are coming in from China fully fabricated. Those are 95% steel. So things like that, where you bypass, the net result is not only do you not get the steel made here anymore, but you're not even getting, they're going for the value added. And then a third area I would just quickly mention is the fact that we're seeing a lot of investment in new steel plants by foreign steel companies in the United States. That's the way they're going to beat tariffs or the risk of trade actions. They're going to set up shop, and they are in a very big way. And a lot of people don't realize. They've got to say, all right, these are all the ramifications in addition to the trade actions, you know, the countering trade actions and filing suits in the World Trade Organization. So all of these things, I think it's important for people to really weigh and say, all right, is it worth it to do this with all these risks on the other side?
Well, all right. So, Ryan Augsburger, I mean, what do you think the hit is? I mean, what's the tipping point for you? Is there a sweet spot in all of this that you think that we could reach, or is it a slippery slope?
Well, we're an advocacy organization, of course, and so there's a lot to celebrate. Record steel production coming out of Ohio. Output from steel has never been higher. And that's true of all manufacturing. And the abundance of downstream customers for that high-quality steel that's made in Ohio and in other parts of the Midwest, a lot of that's coming here anyway for the consumption, the car making. We're number two in automotive assembly, number one in automotive components. So a lot of steel goes into not just the car exterior, but all of the components underneath. Appliance, we're number one. These are two very large consuming industries of steel. So there's a lot to celebrate and to build on. The structural costs that government policies impose, there have been some good policy changes at the state level. There's some strong desire for improved federal reforms, things like tax rate. The U.S. has the highest business tax rate in the world, and that's a problem. But by far, the steel industry feels that the trade issue is the number one problem, and I think that's what you're seeing President Trump reacting to today and ongoing.
And Christopher Plummer, stock prices are up in the steel industry. Is that just a sign of hope? Is that that's not necessarily a concrete indicator going forward, is it?
Well, I think it's a combination, as Ryan was just saying, that, yeah, the markets have improved over the last 3 or 4 years. So things have turned around a bit. Profit margins at steel companies are improving. And I think there is a fair amount of hope and optimism that some of the planned strategies for the economy, for infrastructure and manufacturing will be pushed through and realized in the market. So I do think there's a lot of that positive psychological feeling in the market. Whether that happens is another story. I mean, we've got to have some real concrete results happening in a positive way, or I think that enthusiasm will start to fade fairly quickly.
Christopher Plummer, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Christopher Plummer, steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. Also, Ryan Augsburger of the Ohio Manufacturers Association. Thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time. We will continue our conversation, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking steel today in light of President Trump's threats to impose tough tariffs on imported steel. The president has promised that tariffs will help return manufacturing jobs to the Buckeye State and make America great again. To do that, he is saying that the U.S. faces a national or could face a national security threat from cheap imports. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Dan Guarino. Joining us now is Ohio State University economist Ned Hill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning to you and to Dan.
Okay.
Hello, Ned.
The issue of making America great again, it has a lot more to do with than just tariffs and cheap steel, there are fluctuations in the currency that affect the price of anything that comes from overseas or from Canada or, for that matter, especially Mexico. What is the significance of fluctuations in currency when it comes to manufacturing in Ohio?
Well, it's very, very large. The two sources of pressure on jobs in Ohio manufacturing come from, first, the fantastic increase in productivity, but then the second is indeed currency prices. So quite often people think that a strong dollar is a sign of a very strong United States, but whenever there's a strong dollar, the middle of the country gets hurt because the cost of an imported good becomes cheaper relative to a U.S. manufactured good, and also it gives effectively a wage increase for the U.S. worker, which increase operating costs.
Mm-hmm. And which leads to job cuts often.
Which leads to job cuts, and particularly when you're dealing with a commodity product that is in global oversupply. I mean, the example is the aluminum industry, you know, where we spent in central Ohio years subsidizing Ormet, aluminum smelter that was economically uncompetitive in the eastern part of the state. And Ormet just couldn't compete. And, you know, good in Alcoa, as an example, still has a corporate policy of never building an aluminum smelter because developing countries build them as a matter of national pride. They pay too much, and during downturns, they bankrupt. And that's when Alcoa goes and buys capacity. You know, a piece of steel is a piece of steel, except at the very high quality levels like sheet steel that goes into automotives or into appliances. In Ohio, where we've had a particularly difficult time, is over drill pipe. So you had U.S. Steel shut down the Lorain mill, which they put $750 million in because of dumping of drill pipe, and drill pipe had become, a commodity. But it's no big surprise that all this occurred when the price of natural gas fell and the development of the Utica shale oil fields also slowed down. So cost makes a difference, commodity makes a difference, and what's happening with demand for your product just drives the whole market.
It's not just, then, this dumping of cheap steel.
Oh, no. That's pandering of the lowest sort.
John in Worthington, you're on the air. My guest is Ned Hill. He's an economist at OSU. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing? I just want to say I love your show. You come up with topics that really get your mind going, and there's few shows that do that. I wanted to bring up, first of all, is there a difference between foreign steel and quality versus domestically produced steel? And the second question is, your show has made me realize what a crisis this is, because the previous administration was shutting down electric and coal plants, or coal mines, and without coal, you can't have coke, and that's what makes steel. And if you think back what we went through in World War II, having to build ships, tanks, everything else under the sun, if we found ourselves in that situation and we were relying on imported steel, it would be a real mess for us security-wise. Just want to say thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, John. Is there a difference between foreign and domestic steel?
Well, that's kind of what Ned was just hinting at. For vast parts of the market, for a large number of products, it's going to be a negligible difference. However, for the high end, you're going to see differences. And of course, domestic producers here are going to talk a lot about quality differences. They're going to say that their stuff is better.
But Brian Augsburger did say, I think it was Brian, it might have been Christopher Plummer, something about, particularly with the pipe that's needed for drilling, it has to be the best.
Well, Brian's correct that drill pipe is subject to very rigid standards, because if you have a failure in the pipe, you get all kinds of problems underground, and it is intolerable. There have been court cases that have shown that the mark on pipes that show that it meets standard from some imported pipe has been forged, and that's the dumping aspect. Mm-hmm. The question is that if the pipe does indeed the pipe meet called an ANSI standard. And that's for real. But if you think about rebar, if you think about beam steel, if you think about bar stock, these are commodity products.
Where the quality isn't significant difference.
No, the quality isn't that different. And domestically, we've witnessed this fight between mini mills and the integrated steel plants. The mini mills use scrap and electric arc furnaces, and the integrated mills are like the one up in Cleveland, which takes taconite, iron ore, mixes it with coke, and makes brand new sheet product. For years, the argument was that the product of the mini mills wasn't competitive. It was cheap, generic, and junk. Over the 20-30 year period, the quality of the mini mills have come up drastically, but they still can't make the very high grade sheet that the auto industry and appliance industry depends on. The other big change, and this does have me worried, is that there's a large push to lightweight materials, particularly around automobiles, to increase gas mileage,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is a government mandate, which is triggering and pushing innovation. And that lightweighting means new high-strength, lighter-weight steels. The challenge we have in Ohio is we don't have any metallurgical labs anymore. Middle Steel, which owns the Cleveland plant, their first line of research is in Gary, Indiana. Their second is in Belgium. We do see Timken. Timken does have that R&D facility, and that is the competitive advantage of the mill side of Timken. U.S. Steel does their research out of Pittsburgh, not here. So there is some concern about the ability of mills like the one in Middletown and the other one up in Mansfield, with their ability to innovate new grades and types of steel because they're dependent on a central lab.
And what about what the caller said about the last administration shutting down coal mines? That's debatable. I think it's been pretty clearly shown that it's
complete nonsense.
The oil and gas industry has had a lot bigger impact on coal than any kind of regulations. But be that as it may, I mean, are we in danger? I mean, is there going to be a coke shortage out there?
There is no coke shortage.
Okay.
In fact, the coke is produced out of Pittsburgh and uses very high-grade anthracite. And that coal comes out of Montana and Wyoming. It doesn't come out of the Appalachian Basin anymore.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. For your guest, a general steel question, maybe something a little more specific to Columbus or Ohio. With the president saying that perhaps there should be tariffs on maybe subsidized imports in certain sectors of the steel industries, a thought would be they're doing that in a sense because our steel industry is not competitive. If we're going to impose tariffs on certain sectors of imports, rather than just dump that tariff money back into the general fund, should it be specified that the tariff money be reinvested back in that sector of steel to make it competitive so that in the future we no longer need the tariffs so we can actually go head-to-head with them? South Korea, with their steel industry, their federal government and military similarly subsidized to get them competitive. And once they were competitive, they could stand on their own. And real quick, in Columbus, the closing of Buckeye Steel, not only the plant, but thousands of patents, could that be considered a national security risk that we can no longer manufacture steel rail car beds? And should the Bush family, who actually founded Buckeye Steel, the political family, maybe they have a role to play in this? And that's all. I'll take it off the air.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Okay. Ned Hill, the application of tariff revenue going to the steel industry, I know on a case-by-case basis in the courts, it may be done that way.
Yeah, I would be the real issue is around dumping and other states underwriting and subsidizing their commodities to keep them going for job purposes. To me, the real problem is not it really is the length of time it takes to get a dumping case heard and acted upon. That's a 3 to 4 year process, in which during which time period the plant or the company in the United States that's negligibly involved can die.
Mm-hmm.
Having a quicker judicial process to me is much better than a tariff. A tariff is a very blunt instrument, and tariffs end up ratcheting their way all throughout the economy because of the way in which steel is used. So if suddenly you want to have more expensive bed frames, impose a steel tariff. If you want more expensive rebar and more expensive construction, impose a tariff. Tariffs have funny ways of working, of having large unintended consequences that end up negatively affecting consumers. So I would much rather keep it going through the WTO process, just make it, finding ways through negotiation to make it much faster.
Hmm. Well, as far as China is concerned, when I look at the U.S. versus China, China doesn't pop up in the top 10 or something of importers to the United States when it comes to steel. Is that
correct?
The dumping's happening in other countries, other states that are then dumping it in the United States? Is that how it's working?
U.S. Steel has insinuated and has actually some interesting evidence that the dumping that's coming out of Korea actually is Chinese steel.
Okay.
So what will happen is the feedstock or the basic raw material, the steel blanks, comes out of China and goes to a pipe mill in Korea, and that pipe mill then imports dumps into the United States. Now, the problem with saying that it's trying to figure out where the subsidy is coming from. Is China subsidizing the production of the blank of the raw steel, or is Korea subsidizing the keeping the pipe plant up and going? That's the tricky part.
And then the idea of prefabrication, again, Christopher Plummer brought that up last segment. What are your thoughts about that? Do the tariffs apply when things are prefabricated, like, you know, trusses for bridges and that kind of a thing?
That all depends on how the tariff law is
written. How they write it, yeah.
And how it's graded. I mean, yeah, it's quite interesting. A large part of the San Francisco Bay Bridge was prefabricated in China and brought over.
Hmm. You mean the one that collapsed?
No, the one that replaced the one that collapsed.
Okay. Okay. The quality, you said it really matters on certain things, but when it comes to rebar and things like that, it doesn't so much matter?
Well, yeah, because it is much more of a commodity. Now, you've seen moving away from steel, think about wallboard.
Okay.
We've always treated wallboard as a commodity until you found out that some of the wallboard coming out of China didn't have gypsum in it and was carcinogenic. That's a real problem. So it is important that end-use customers check the quality of the material that they're buying.
What's the upshot of this? I mean, are these what are your thoughts, Ned Hill? Is this are these idle threats? All the things that you're saying, everybody else, it's pretty easy to understand the cascading effect of a tariff. I'm sure there are computer programs out there that you can punch in with this kind of stuff, right?
You could. There are econometric programs which will magically spit out a number that will give. Do an argument. The thing about tariffs is that they've always been used for protectionism. I remember Senator Voinovich and I had a conversation where we were talking about dumping and steel tariffs. And last time we put a big tariff on steel, he was backing it because it was an Ohio product.
Mm-hmm.
But he did mention that a constituent in Ohio needed a special grade steel that he couldn't get in the United States. And so the senator slipped in a provision exempting that one little grade of steel to help out a constituent. I grew up in Connecticut where U.S. rubber was big. They made Keds. And for years, sneakers had very high tariffs because the congressman from Waterbury, Connecticut, made certain that the tariffs on imported sneakers were quite high to protect the uncompetitive. You know, sewing sneakers in Connecticut made no sense. So U.S. customers U.S. consumers for years paid over prices for kegs and Converse that were too high to protect a mill.
I couldn't afford them.
There you go.
I remember those days. They were pricey. Ned Hill, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a delight.
Ned Hill, economist at Ohio State University. And Dan Guarino, thanks as always for your help today. Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, appreciate your time as well.
Good to be here.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your emails. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.